Great. Welcome to the Brookline Can Older Adults Housing Forum on the expanded supply of senior housing in Brookline. This is a follow-up to another forum done 7 years ago by the Age Friendly Cities Group and the Brookline Can. It was sponsored by both of them. That forum recognized our impressive history, ours being Brookline, in senior housing, our growth in older participation, and it also identified future needs for seniors. Housing is needed, but no senior housing has been added since 190 Harvard Street in the 1980s and the Goddard Assisted Living in the 1990s. This year is a welcome change. We have 5 projects. The forum will be available afterwards on YouTube, on Brookline Interactive Group or BIG, and Brookline Can websites. Also, it will be on Brookline Can Facebook and Twitter accounts. The Brookline Can website has an easy sign up to become a member. Just click on Get Involved in the menu. It's an all-volunteer organization providing leadership for advocacy and action, educational forums like this one, and networking and interaction with older adults in Brookline. Our keynote speaker today is Jennifer Malinsky of the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. She'll speak on the need for more senior housing. Dr. Malinsky is a senior research associate at JCHS and a lecturer in urban planning and design. She's the lead author on several publications related to the needs of older adults. Prior to joining JCHS, she served as the chief planner for long-range planning in Newton. She holds a PhD in urban planning from MIT. Welcome, Dr. Malinsky.
Thank you so much, Matt, and thank you very much for having me tonight. I'm very excited to be part of this conversation. I'm going to share my screen and get started. So as you mentioned, I work at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. We are a 60-year-old research center focusing on housing. I'm also a neighbor. I live in Newton in addition to having worked there. And of course, many of the issues that we'll talk about tonight resonate for all of us in this region. The Joint Center began looking in earnest at the housing issues surrounding the nation's aging population about 6 years ago. And since then, we've written 4 reports on the topic that you can see here, as well as a host of working papers and academic articles. And the information tonight from this talk is drawn largely from the report that we released last fall, as well as other ongoing work that you can find on our website. Today, I'm going to touch on 2 questions. Do we as a nation have the housing we need to support a growing older population? The answer to that is sadly simple. We do not. We lack housing, sufficient supply of housing that older adults can afford, that is physically accessible to those with mobility, disabilities, and frailties that come with age, and that is located in places that have supports for older people, from amenities to services. And I'll talk about these briefly tonight. The second question asks how we might support those wishing to age in community. Recent surveys of older adults' living preferences reveal that most older adults would like to remain in their current communities for as long as possible. To some, this means any scenario in which they remain in their hometown, aging in their community, while others think of aging in community as a setting that intentionally supports social life and well-being, often within one's current town or city. And I think many of the panelists tonight will get to the latter. First, a couple of quick statistics. The urgency of this conversation is driven by the growth of the older population itself, a result of increased longevity and the aging of the large baby boom population. Right now, we're seeing a swelling of population among those in their 60s and 70s, which is the leading edge of that baby boom. But in the next decade, households in their 80s will be the fastest growing group in the nation. As you can see in the far right column, the number of households headed by someone 80 or over is expected to double within the next 20 years. By 2038, over a third of households in the US will be headed by someone 65 or over and 12% headed by someone 80 or over. I can't stress enough how unprecedented this is and how it creates this urgency when we come to housing, When baby boomers reach age 80 and beyond in the next decade, we can really expect to see quickly growing demand for living environments that are more supportive of people with physical challenges who live alone and who have limited incomes to spend on housing. I was just speaking here about people who run their own households, and indeed most of the nation's 50 million older adults, those 65 and over, do live in their own households. That's the large blue area of the pie chart. And most of that blue area includes people who live as couples or who live alone. About 20% of older people live multi-generationally, some in their own homes, some with children. The bottom line, though, is that the vast majority live in the community in some way. Only about 3% of older adults live in nursing homes, which is called group quarters in that chart. One consequence of the growth in the population of those in their 80s and beyond is that we expect to see more single-person households going forward. Right now, 57% of those 80 and over live alone. And as that 80-plus population grows, we expect that those numbers will just grow. And in fact, nearly double in the next two decades. So let me dive into the first gap we have in the supply of housing, which is the affordable supply. We have a national housing affordability crisis, one that Boston area residents know all too well. Older adults experience this in particular ways. Incomes tend to decline with age, including for individuals, not just on the average. Some housing costs may keep going up though. Renters may see higher rents, the cost of utilities can rise, there's property taxes and insurance paid by homeowners. And so I'll cover in a few minutes how we measure affordability by all these things. But in addition, we may see new costs. Older adults may need to modify their homes if they'd like to stay there to make them safe and accessible. Or they may need more support in the home, from maintenance to help with housework to health aides, creating added costs of remaining in one's home. So let's just look at the basic affordability question. Housing affordability is a function of the price of housing and the resources we have to pay for it. So a standard measure of affordability is whether housing costs are within 30% of a household's income. And housing costs include rent, mortgage, property tax, insurance, utilities. If housing is more than 30% of income, we say that a household is housing cost burdened. So by this standard measure, about a third of the nation's 30 million older households are unaffordably housed. And another 10 million households in the 50s to 64 age group are cost burdened as well. And about half of all of those are paying more than 50% of their income for housing. This chart shows the millions of households that face cost burdens by their status as renter, as an owner with a mortgage, and an owner without a mortgage. And you can see here that older renters and people with mortgages are more likely to be cost burdened, and also you're more likely to be cost burdened as you age, which is a fact of declining incomes, but perhaps rising costs. In terms of the mortgages, 26% of mortgages age, 26% of owners age 80 and over have a mortgage today, which is up from 3% just three decades ago. In Massachusetts, the story is that more homeowners are likely to be cost burdened than the national average. Renters here look like renters elsewhere, but that is still a dire situation with over half of older renters facing cost burdens. All of this matters because the more you spend on housing, the less there is available to spend on other necessities. This chart focuses only on low-income households, with the blue bar those who are paying within 30% of their income for housing, and the green bars those who are paying more than half of their income on housing. And you can see the dramatic differences in outlays for food and health in particular. So housing affordability has really everything to do with food security and with health. So what to do about this? Obviously, there are government programs that can help subsidize housing for those who meet income requirements, including vouchers and public housing. But in this country at this time, housing is not an entitlement. Just because you qualify does not mean you receive assistance. Indeed, only about a third of those who qualify do receive that assistance. And that's the represented in the green part of that, the first set of bars. With the older population growing, what we expect is that a lot more people will need assistance, yet just keeping pace with this third that we serve now is going to be a challenge. And worse, to do this projection, we assume that the income distribution would stay the same as it is today, but there's really reason to think that with widening income inequality, this will not be the case, and so that we have underestimated the amount of need going forward. I was asked to talk tonight about the diversity of housing needs, and it's important to note that renters and owners are often very different positions with regard to their housing options. We certainly have a lot of higher income renters than we have a lot of luxury housing in this area to show that. But on average, renters have much lower incomes than do owners. They also have much less wealth. The median older renter in this country has less than $7,000 in total assets. The median older owner, meanwhile, has a net wealth of nearly $320,000, with housing wealth just under half that. Even if you break down renters and owners by income and look just at lower income owners and lower income renters, the story holds. But you can also see in this chart another fact, which is that the less income an owner household has, the more likely their wealth is tied up in their home. Lower income homeowners tend to have fewer liquid assets, which makes it tricky to do things like major renovations to a house without getting at that equity through some kind of mechanism. Lastly, the only other thing I want to point out here is that there are vast differences in wealth, income, and likelihood of being unaffordably housed by race and ethnicity. And you can see that here in terms of the very big differences in median income, in the housing equity that owners have, and overall wealth. One of the reasons for this is the historic gap in homeownership between white households and those headed by a person of color. Indeed, the gap in ownership between older Black and white households is at a 30-year high. Much of this disparity is tied to long-term institutional injustice in housing policy that began generations ago, but has lasting effects. So the affordability challenge. For individuals, those who have the means to plan ahead would do well to think about the cost of housing remaining in their housing or moving, but also what that might mean in terms of supportive services or modifications. And I'll get into a little bit of the policy at the end, but for a community, I think this really means allowing many more housing options than we often see: accessory dwelling units, apartments in villages. We clearly need more subsidy, as I talked about, for construction and for rents. And as the population ages, we are seeing a greater number of people who are experiencing homelessness who are older. And so we first want to prevent that. But second, to the extent that that is occurring, we're going to need to provide care and services for that group, which is a bit different from younger adults. And finally, middle-income older adults who don't qualify for subsidies but live in expensive areas like this one have very few options if they want to move. Reverse mortgages are one thing that people might want to do to get some of the equity out of their house. I think what's exciting, though, is that recently some nonprofit organizations, including those on this webinar, are figuring out ways to serve this vast market with mixed-use projects, mixing different levels of affordability, and I hope that we can get into that later. A second gap is in the lack of accessible housing, housing that is safe and can be fully accessed by people with physical challenges. Our nation's housing stock on the whole is woefully inaccessible, and it's worse in the Northeast. So we can see that needs for accessibility increase with age. That mobility line juts up in the late 70s. And this is true for people from all incomes, races, ethnicities. And when we looked at to see if we have housing to support a growing older population that might need more accessible units, we looked at data on a few household features. We looked at single floor living. If you could live on one floor, a no-step entry into the home, and extra wide hallways and doorways that might accommodate a wheelchair if needed. And our analysis shows that only 3.5% of all housing in the US has these three features together. And even those three alone would not make a unit fully accessible. It says nothing about the accessibility of the bathroom, just that there is one on the first floor, for instance. So large multifamily buildings tend to be the best if they're newer, but even that is less than 10% of their stock. And again, the Northeast kind of falls short on all of these things due to the age of our housing stock, the style, the topography we have. The kinds of features that are helpful, no-step entries, the lever-style handles on doors and showers, faucets, the walk-in showers. Some of these photos were taken at Two Life's Golda Meir house, including the toilet paper holder that doubles as a grab bar, which I always find very inventive. The accessible switches and outlets, and then the kitchen on the top. We don't necessarily need to make every unit of housing fully accessible, but there is a growing interest in making it easier to adapt our homes to make it easier to do so later. So putting in reinforcements in the bathroom walls in case we want to add grab bars later. And in some cases, we might rely on technology to solve some of our problems going forward. Smaller footprint wheelchairs, for instance, or stair climbing wheelchairs. But these are not really widely used enough now to say that they're widespread solutions. A host of checklists and guides can help people evaluate home for things that could be safety hazards or that could become accessibility challenges in the future. So this is something that individuals can do. At the community level, we're also looking at communities that are mandating that new housing have some basic accessibility features. These are called visitability ordinances. In Massachusetts and most states, accessibility in private homes is not required if there are fewer than 4 units in a building. So some states and localities are addressing this through these kinds of ordinances, and the state of Vermont actually has a statewide. And finally, there is a need to help people pay for the changes to their homes, as these can be expensive. And there are a host of programs such as these listed on the slide, from tax incentives to volunteer programs. In some cases, long-term care insurance or Medicaid waivers are helping to pay for this. But what key is that these funds are often only available to those with documented disabilities and not to those seeking to make their home easier or safer in order to remain in it. So that's something I think we need to think about. And renters too can have challenges. Legally, they are allowed, if needed, to make a modification to their unit, but often must return it to its original state upon leaving the unit. One of the things that we have studied at the Joint Center is aging and subsidized units. So those units receiving federal assistance typically have more accessibility features, and those that were often paid for by the property owner. So very, very briefly, the third challenge I want to touch on is the need for supportive services. Housing affordability and accessibility are major concerns for those considering where to live in older age, but so too is the potential need for supportive services brought into the home. This can be costly, and the annual costs of a lot of that care exceed the income of most older adults. So these are national and Massachusetts average costs for these different services. Compared to the median income for households 65 and over. And it really, I think, shows how limited people's incomes are in terms of paying for these services should they need them, which brings you to wealth. But again, the wealth of some of our older adults, including renters, would really let you pay for even less than 1 month of these services. So there's a real need here to figure out an efficient way to deliver services to older people. And to keep them healthier longer so that there is less need for the more intensive services. And there's a growing emphasis on this, of course. There's programs like SASH in Vermont, which are helping older adults prevent illness and injury through care coordination programs. And there's something that the other panelists will talk about tonight, which is a growing segment of housing for older adults that fits between individual living, a single family home or apartment, and assisted living, but that is service enriched and offers a slate of programs and services that support older adults' health and quality of life. Lastly, I just want to touch very briefly on location. Where one lives matters to their ability to access services, amenities, medical care, transportation, and this all falls under the rubric of age-friendly communities. Brookline is one of them. Massachusetts is one of a handful of age-friendly states in the nation. So I won't go into detail here, but what I think is critical is that when people want to stay in their communities for as long as possible, it is really important that people have the support they need outside of their homes. It's all well and good to have an affordable, safe home, but if there's no engagement, if there's no way to maintain connections or build new relationships, it can become lonely and isolating, and loneliness and social isolation have their own health effects. So to conclude, the challenges I think we face are many. We are not, my managing director often jokes that we are the Joint Center for gloom and doom sometimes. My intent is not to just provide all the bad news. It's, I think, to lay out the challenges, but also to point to some of the solutions. And I think that's what the rest of the panel will do. There is no one-size-fits-all approach. I really think we need a lot of options. Some people want to live multi-generationally. Some people want to live with other older adults. Some people want to live in their single family house. But we need more affordable options, especially in this region where downsizing can be more expensive than the house you leave. And we need to figure out ways to support modifications to the home even before they're needed, not after someone has a documented disability, and continue to develop and evaluate creative programs to bring services to people at home. And lastly, that opportunities to engage is just so important to prevent social isolation and loneliness. So I'll end there, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Malinsky. And let's see if we can generate some discussion here. And I expect you to either participate or fully in. Now let's meet the panel. Each one's going to present a little bit of an overview and a presentation on what they're involved in and their background. The first person is Cindy Katziff. Cindy's the executive director of Brown Family Residence at 370 Harvard. Brown is built and run by Two Life, and as I just understand, it's very near to completion. Cindy?
Hello. Thank you for having me today. I'm very...
There they go.
Cindy, you're muted.
Can you hear me? Okay. I'm Cindy Katziff, Executive Director and Director of Resident Services of the Brown Family House. I want to thank Brookline Can and Frank Caro and all the other members of this forum for bringing to light this incredibly, incredibly needed service that we need to provide for our senior adults. Brown Family House is one campus of Two Life communities. Founded in 1965 as Jewish Community Housing for the Elderly, we are non-sectarian and welcoming to seniors of all backgrounds. We are dedicated to providing superior housing that is broadly affordable. Two Life has developed 8 houses in 4 communities. We have over 1,000 apartments and over 1,500 residents who call us home. You may know us as Golden Meyer or Coleman House in Newton, as Shillman House in Framingham, or as Yulin, Leventhal, Curlat, or Weinberg in Brighton, and now you will know us as the Harold and Ronald Brown House in Brookline. Our housing is designed with a laser-sharp focus on affordability. 93% of our apartments are subsidized, and the median yearly income of our residents is $10,100. Brown Family House has 62 apartments, of which 75% are low-income, or for low-income seniors. Brown's leasing was done by lottery. We opened the lottery on February 14th for applications. We closed it on May 1st. During that time, because of COVID, we could not do any in-person information sessions, and yet we got over 700 applications for 60 available apartments. I think that speaks volumes to the need for affordable housing. All of the apartments in Brown are now rented, and we expect our renters, our wonderful, wonderful residents, to start moving in at the end of this month. Massachusetts has the nation's second largest shortfall between income and basic living expenses. No one should have to decide between housing or food. But you're here tonight because you know that. You understand the need, you've heard the statistics, and you have acknowledged that there's something we need to do about it. Now I'd like to tell you a little bit more about Brown specifically, and the ability to address the quality of affordable housing at this particular home. So Two Life is committed to the idea of resident centricity. I am a resident services coordinator, director of resident services, and as a resident service coordinator, we do and make decisions to help our residents live the best life they can. We believe in resident centricity, which means the resident is at the forefront of all of our decisions. As a resident service coordinator, I help residents to find the services, the activities, the programs, and the communities that will help them live their best possible life. I also can help with paperwork. I'm there to lend an ear, and I'm there to help solve any issues that may come up that will enable them to stay with us and to live the life they would like to live. At Brown, we have 2 apartments for residents, for site representatives. In Brown, we also have 2 apartments for the 2 site reps. They live on site. So in each apartment, there are 2 pull cords for emergency purposes. If a resident pulls a pull cord at any time, a staff person, someone they know, will come to make sure they're okay and to get them the help they need. This can be at 3 p.m. or 3 a.m. in the morning. During COVID-19, we have been very, very busy keeping our residents safe and providing for the needs that they have told us that they have and for those that we were able to foresee. We have been able to help them with their laundry. We've been able to bring them meals. We've helped them with personal care items. We get their mail for them. We take out their trash. And we've been able to still provide laundry service. And all of this we're doing for free. There's no cost to the resident because we recognize how incredibly difficult it is for a resident to stay and shelter in their home during the pandemic. We also make supportive phone calls to the residents to check on them, to make sure they're okay, and to address anything that they want to bring up to us. We've been able to provide Chromebooks so that residents who don't have Wi-Fi ability or computers can not only take advantage of programs that are online, but they can reach out to their family members and do have FaceTime and conversations, things that are so very, very important right now. At Brown, residents will have the advantage of aging in community. We know that social isolation and loneliness are extremely detrimental to one's physical and mental well-being. Brown residents will have multiple classes, events, and programs within the building, but they also have access to an amazing amount of programs right in Coolidge Corner, of shops, of restaurants, and other entertainment activities. And then we're also adjoined to the campus at 384, where there are a number of wonderful host organizations inviting our residents to join them. Now, I understand that during COVID-19, it's rather difficult, but all of these programs are waiting and will be put into place as soon as it is safe to do so. We're also very, very lucky to be near the Senior Center in Brookline, and we forged an amazing relationship with the center as well as the communities at 100 Center Street. We feel very, very lucky that we'll be able to share services and programming with both places. We'll also be inviting center community residents to partake in some of our classes that we hold on a weekly basis. Those are regular. We already do them in our other sites, so we're delighted to be able to open up this door for everyone too. Brown Family House has been designed to embrace the concept of village centers. Our walls are permeable. We have designed specific spaces where the community will feel comfortable to come in, to sit down, to maybe enjoy a program or music, or just schmooze. We'll have Wi-Fi on the first floor, so anybody that needs to access that has that ability. There's a beautiful fireplace, soft, comfortable chairs, and a great table to sit around and meet new friends, make new friends, and for our residents to come down and enjoy that ability too. Brown is a sustainable and a green building, but I have a feeling I've run out of time. So thank you. I'm just gonna run through my screen right now so you can see. These pictures were taken quite recently. This is the Brown Family House of last week. And this is our front entrance. It's gonna be a beautiful, beautiful entrance for the neighborhood. This is looking out at the fireplace and out the front door. I apologize that we're not quite done, but I thought you'd wanna see exactly what we're doing, which is what we had said we would do, is make this a beautiful space for the entire community. In this corner will be a table with chairs, and people will be able to gather around and enjoy it. There's another shot of the lobby, and you look through to that beautiful glass room, which is our activities room, where people will be invited in to listen to lectures and music and have joyous celebrations. Our lobby, going up to the upper apartments, and the fun stuff, the mailboxes. This is our courtyard. We have a courtyard in the middle of the building. It's beautiful and it's coming together in a most gorgeous way. Those are permeable pavers that you see so that water can drain through them. And just another shot as they're finishing up. And then this is the view off of the sixth floor. We have an amazing balcony where residents will be able to come out and enjoy time with each other. And as Jennifer mentioned, we have the specific type of door handle so that it's safe and easy for residents to enter and exit their apartments in the building. There's the intercom system you see when our resident services, our resident representatives get a call on a pool cord. They can talk to the resident and immediately go to the apartment. And we have the ability for the residents to see who's calling them from downstairs on that third pad. And then that is the kitchen. It's just beautiful. I can't say enough about the way I think our real estate department developed this amazing site. And the flooring in the living room. Finally, the bedroom with that gorgeous closet. The bathroom, which as you'll see, has a low entry tub. All the apartments have that. And an amazing linen closet and lots of room to access. And the last shot of the Brown family house from a different direction. And if you need to contact me, here's my information.
Okay. I sit on the bench sometimes across the street, just watch the thing going up, and it's moving really fast. It's people watch it working. I mean, everybody's completely concentrating and working in long periods of time. So it's going to get there. When do you have a date yet?
At the very end of September, we believe we'll be able to open and bring in our first new residents to their new home.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Thanks, Cindy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Our next panelist is Tate. We have Cheryl Fever from Welltower, and we have Michael Schonbrunn of Balfour, Balfour Senior Living Community. He's the CEO and founder. Balfour is going to be built on Fisher Hill at the former site of the Newberry College. It's also, Cheryl is of Welltower, as I said, and Welltower is the ones who purchased the Newberry College site and is building Balfour. So we know the area. The area is fantastic. Let's hear about Balfour. Mike, Michael?
Thank you, Matt. I'm going to lead the presentation and Cheryl will be available for any follow-up questions and answers. If we can have the first slide, please. Thank you. This is a view of our entry. We have several views that you'll see here, but this is a the east side of the former Newberry College. The west side, on the west side of Fisher Avenue, will be determined by the town and future decisions made. But under the terms, we have the 3.5 acres that are on the east side. Next slide, please. Brief background on Balfour. It was founded in Colorado in 1997. I started it. It's a family-owned business. My wife, Susan, who is both our general counsel and our in charge of our interior decorating and architecture, is involved. We currently have 8 communities in Colorado, 1 in Ann Arbor. We offer a continuum of care. So we do independent living, assisted living, and memory care. All of our apartment homes are rental. That is in distinction from entry fee community CCRCs. It's really a month to month. We feel strongly about that. We're only as good as last month's activities program, last month's meal program, and transportation. So keeps us on our toes. It makes it in some ways more affordable because people don't have to take their life savings and put it down into the entry fee. We can go to the next slide, please. Our partner, as Matt has already mentioned, is Welltower. Welltower is a real estate investment trust, New York Stock Exchange company. They own and develop senior housing, assisted living, memory care communities, as well as post-acute communities and medical office buildings throughout the United States. Welltower does not operate the communities. They find companies like Balfour and others either under a triple net lease or in a management agreement. The project, as mentioned before, or at least I should have mentioned, we have not yet started construction, so we can show you beautiful pictures without yet having anything but even a hole in the ground yet. So you're going to be seeing some of our pictures of going forward. So we move to the next slide. This is a view. If you look on the left, the red brick building is the the Mitten House, which is a very important Brookline landmark, which we're delighted we'll be using and refurbishing. The rest of the building will be new, and what we're looking at will be both independent living and assisted and memory care. Next slide, please. This is the view from Holland Road. You can see to the right, the Mitten House, and we've made every effort to make the architecture fit as much as possible into the Fisher Hill neighborhood, very respectful of the wonderful Olmsted heritage in this neighborhood and the beautiful homes around it. Next, please. Here's a view from Holland of Mitten House. We're keeping the entire building. We're going to go through some pretty extensive interior renovations. There will be 8 apartments in the building, plus leasing offices and storage units. And we're delighted to incorporate this into our plan. We've done something similar in Denver with another historic building. And it really provides a great center of gravity for the neighborhood and recognize the respect we have for the communities that we're building in. Next. We'll have a total of 160 apartment homes. I'll get into the split, but basically 80 independent, 40 assisted, 40 memory. And the view you see here is in our renovated building Moffitt Depot in Denver. So these are all pictures of existing Balfour properties. We take a lot of pride in our interior design and architecture, and we'll be doing absolutely the same, if not higher quality in Brookline. Next, please. I've mentioned already the split here of independent living, assisted living, memory care. We do allow pets. Not always on the furniture. That one happens to be my dog who gets away with murder. But we're big believers that this is our residents' home. We want them to entertain children and grandchildren. People have cats and dogs. We're not sure if there's any other more exotic pets. But as long as they stay in the apartments, I think, and they don't eat other animals, you'd probably be okay with it. Next. We're going to have a pool in our Brookline community. This is the pool we have in our Denver property. This will be a solar covered, and we're going to be examining very carefully the possibility of at least partially heating the pool with solar as well. Next. Transportation is hugely important, as mentioned, for seniors. We have a transportation fleet with drivers for our residents. And in Brookline, as in our most recent properties, we have a fleet of Tesla cars to shuttle people back and forth with no pollution. We also will be running a shuttle service to the T-Line to bring our staff to the residency itself so that they'll limit drive and pollution and traffic. And we're also, as has been mentioned during the town meeting discussions, having shifts of our employees at off hours so they don't compete with school time and rush hour. Next, please. Finishing really up now with the last two slides. We think there are substantial benefits to Brookline. In addition to the folks who will be living in the community, there'll be the adaptive reuse of the Mitten House. There's a contribution that we'll be making to the Brookline affordable housing, and you'll hear more about that later from other speakers. This will be a LEED Gold certified project. We're very committed to sustainability. Welltower very much has that as part of its corporate credo, as does Balfour. And important to note that this property, unlike its predecessor, College Use, will be a full tax-paying entity, which will help with financing of other town services and benefits. And we're happy to play that role. And then lastly, in our next slide, please. We've made a commitment that we're very happy to live up to, and we've done this in our other communities, that we open up some of these public spaces for meetings with our neighbors. Brookline community groups will have access. We're going to be very supportive in both bringing our residents to attend senior-focused activities elsewhere in town. Work closely with Brookline High School, especially their culinary arts program, and the Teen Center job fair. We very much want to be a good neighbor. We believe very strongly that senior communities, for those seniors that do want to live among their peers, thanks. Not a multi-generational, want to be involved with the neighborhood as well and be a good neighbor.
Thank you. I wouldn't let you go cut you off on this slide because this is great. Really great. Okay, I'd like to go, as you mentioned, Mike Jacobs, who's chair of the Brookline Housing Authority, BAJ, and he's a member of the Brookline Housing Advisory Board, we call HAB. And Welltower paid a little over $6 million, I believe, to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And that money gives BAJ the ability to replace the existing Colonel Floyd and add 60 units, something like that, something around 60 units. So I'll let Mike tell you. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Matt. Colonel Floyd is of the BHA's freestanding senior properties in North Brookline. Colonel Floyd is unique, unfortunately, in a as an example of not how to build senior housing. The 60-unit senior and disabled property consists of six buildings, which are two-story walk-ups, while the other five senior properties are mid to high-rise elevator buildings with community services. Colonel Floyd has no accessible units, no community spaces for social services or gatherings, outdated systems that rely on fossil fuels, and the one-bedroom units are incredibly small at 388 square feet. They're about two-thirds the size of the state standards for one-bedroom units. A few years ago, the BHA was lucky to be awarded by HUD money from the what is called the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program to convert public housing operating subsidies to project-based Section 8. We're quite thrilled by that. What it does is allows residents to continue to pay only 30% of their income for rent. But what it gives the BHA is the ability to access tax-exempt bonds for loans and to access private equity markets to rehabilitate our buildings. What that does also for residents is we can now rehabilitate, upgrade kitchens and baths, put in new systems, and now two of our properties are under construction. So it is it has been a godsend for the BHA. Unfortunately, when we looked at Colonel Floyd, we realized that investing millions of dollars in a property which seniors could not age in place really did not seem like a wise investment. However, when you look at the property and we looked at the existing zoning, the availability of transportation, the lack of need for automobiles, a waiting list of over 4,000 seniors, it made sense to add approximately 40, 40 new units on the 1.2-acre site. A new 100-unit elevator building would have multiple positive impacts. Not only would we add the 40 new units, but we would enable 60 current Brookline residents to better age in place and a service-enriched environment, which is really obviously pretty critical for our seniors. So the development would provide accessible units. It would also reduce isolation by eliminating barriers preventing seniors from visiting each other in the building and create community spaces fostering interaction. Those community spaces would also enable the BHA and local service providers to better serve residents. Now, the reason you're not going to see fancy slides from me tonight is we're really in the very early stages in this process. We are in the point of recommending an entire architectural and engineering team to the BHA board next week. And that group will now begin working on plans, meeting with residents, meeting with the community at large to begin the permitting process. You know, town meeting, as was mentioned by Matt and by Michael, awarded $6.5 million contribution from Welltower, which was a godsend and a once in a generation award to us. But this is a $50 to $55 million project, and we're going to be submitting applications to the state and the Federal Home Loan Bank over the next many months to find the balance of that funding as we advance our plans. We are incredibly excited about this process and look forward to working with many of the people on this panel and probably in the audience over the next couple of months. Thanks very much.
Really exciting. Really exciting, Mike. I mean, it's, I got a tour of and just pictures and discussions. And really exciting. I can't, it's right in the center of Coolidge Corner. It's location's tremendous, like everybody else. and it's really exciting. It's time. It's pretty old, Colonel Floyd. It's time. It's really time. I think we're gonna watch this project anxiously. And let's go on. Can I move on with Rhonda? Are we okay, Mike?
Yes.
So Rhonda. Well, let me introduce you quickly. You're the head of the Center Communities of Brookline, CCB, owned and operated by the Hebrew Sea of Life. The Center Street development is planned is next to 100 Center Street, correct? And why don't you tell us about it?
Thank you so much, Matt. Happy to. And thank you, Frank, and everyone involved in Brookline Can for convening this forum. And good evening, everyone. One moment, please, while I share my slides with you. Okay, again, good evening. I'm Rhonda Gleiman, Executive Director at Center Communities of Brookline. I'm excited to be with you tonight to share our early concepts for an expanded senior living campus in Coolidge Corner, as it offers a unique opportunity to meet the needs of people across Brookline. Brookline has been at the forefront of vision and achievements for seniors since the founding of its Council on Aging, one of the oldest in the country. Healthy aging research shows that having a sense of attachment to home and community relates positively to health and well-being in older age. Loneliness, as you've heard, is the biggest threat to healthy aging, and of course, most seniors want to remain in their community as they age. Hebrew Senior Life was founded in 1903 by a small group of community members who wanted better care for their loved ones. HSL is a nonprofit, non-sectarian organization serving over 3,000 people a day across 6 Boston area campuses. Our mission is to honor our elders by respecting and promoting their independence, spiritual vigor, dignity, and choice, and by recognizing that they are a resource to be cherished. We welcome residents of all faiths and backgrounds and accept special responsibility for the frailest and neediest members of our community. We are a national leader in the field of aging and the only senior care organization in the country affiliated with Harvard Medical School. Since we purchased Center Communities in 2002, we've added many services to support residents in living their best life, including social services, spiritual care, and a wide array of educational, cultural, and recreational programs, along with physical therapy, home health care, and our on-site Harvard-affiliated medical practice, all adding to CCB's strong sense of community. Today, there is a need for additional senior living and spaces for social engagement in Brookline that enhance the quality of life for people as they age. The Brookline Senior Center is bursting at the seams. The senior population in Brookline continues to grow, and recent market research indicates significant excess demand for assisted living and independent living communities in Brookline. Working together with Two Life Communities and the Brookline Senior Center, we have envisioned a creative way to meet this challenge. Our idea is to develop our existing footprint in Coolidge Corner into a dynamic, welcoming, and attractive senior hub, a mini neighborhood that would comprise enriched senior living, a shared community center, and public spaces for multi-generational activities. Enriched senior living would include assisted living, independent living, or both, market rate and affordable units, and Hebrew Senior Life's integrated, high quality, person-centered care for all. The environmentally sustainable campus would be located on our Center Street land, shown here. As you can see, the Brookline Senior Center's land above in blue is adjacent to ours. If we are fortunate to move forward, the campus could connect to the Brookline Senior Center, thus making it easier to access from Harvard Street. Importantly, the intergenerational senior hub could offer additional community areas for creative arts, fitness, and lifelong learning, along with outdoor green space, healthy homemade meals, and amenities designed to keep people active, engaged, and independent. As we move forward, collaborative planning, shared information, and an inclusive atmosphere of trust and respect are of paramount importance. We look forward to working with you to create a world-class campus in Brookline that will meet the needs of seniors and their loved ones today and for generations to come. Thank you for your kind attention. Thank you.
Rhonda, that's exciting.
Thank you. I'm excited. We're all excited.
I didn't know what you're going to say, but I'm really excited. That's really great. And now we have, last but not least, Amy Scheckman. Amy is president and executive director of Two Life. She was Brookline's first economic development director. For 7 years, the air above the parking lot between Kent Street and Station Street was discussed as affordable senior housing. A feasibility study, finally, several years ago, took place. An RFP was recommended, and it selected a vendor for a specific proposal. There were three bidders, and Two Life won less than 2 months ago. But Amy, we still want to hear about it, even though it's okay. Great.
I'm gonna talk about what I can talk about, because the truth is we were just selected, and there's a lot of work to do in negotiating with different details with the town. So let me share what I can and take questions, and also recognizing the time, I'll be brief. So what I can say about Kent Street is everything we're gonna do is consistent with our vision and our mission and how we do everything. And so let me just start with our mission in life. And we are zealots, and I'm unabashedly zealots for what I think is a good cause, which is that every older adult deserves the opportunity to live a full life of connection and purpose in a dynamic, supportive environment. And we do that, as Cindy mentioned, with a laser sharp focus on affordability. So when Jennifer or Dr. Malinsky talks about looking through her study, where are the gaps? Our commitment is that we are going to fill the gaps. Another way to say this, we only go where the market fails. We're not interested. Where people can make money, do stuff, mazel tov, let them do that. We're going to go to the people who can't meet, who can't get what they need in the market. And so at Kent Street, like at Brown House, 100% of our units are affordable and subsidized, even though Cindy mentioned 75% for extremely low income. But we asked the HAB, the Housing Advisory Board, to give us guidance on what the levels of affordability should be. And we followed those, figuring that the town's Housing Advisory Board would know best what are the levels of affordability. 100% are affordable. 100% of Kent Street will also be affordable. And when we do affordable, we make a commitment to affordability in perpetuity. So that's a guarantee that we're willing to provide. Cindy did mention that we have people living on site, and that's really important. Let me just give you a reason. Last year, when people pulled their pull cords in the middle of the night, 90-something, I think it was 92, but it might be 91, in that order, over 90% of the time, we were able to resolve the issues without a 911 call and without a visit to an emergency room. That is absolutely critical for people's long-term safety and stability. The other thing that is just a given in everything we do, and so Matt, I hope soon, instead of sitting across the street looking at what, you will sit in a nice pocket park that we are building for the community's use on the site. We will build a pocket park on the site of Kenton Station Street. It will be smaller because the site is smaller, but you will see us there. We're hoping to build as many as 54 apartments. And again, we need to negotiate. I mean, the critical question at Kent Station Street is, right now our proposal envisions replacing 100% of the parking. When you replace 100% of the parking, you lose some of the affordability that you might otherwise get. It's a trade-off. The town needs to make the trade-off, and we're willing to do whatever the town advises us to do. The other standard operating practice for us, I was really glad to see Jennifer mention the importance of accessibility and adaptability. We made a decision quite a while ago that 100% of our units are always going to be adaptable. So we not only do universal design, including when we modernize very old buildings, and this is quite unusual, we make 100% of the units adaptable. What that means is all it will take is a maintenance guy with a screwdriver to transform the unit instantly to a wheelchair accessible unit. So we're not just doing the 5% ADA units, we're gonna make 100% adaptable, because no one knows what's gonna happen, and staying in the place that you build as your community is really important. We spend an awful lot of time on sensitive design. I have pictures, I'm not gonna show them now because it's getting late, but if people wanna see, like the pictures of Brown Family House, the pictures we'll do are extremely sensitive, with a very welcoming front to Station Street right across from the T stop, as well as a sensitive behind on Kent Street to meet that neighbor, the way it fits. We do everything as an enterprise, does a green community, and very adaptable, accessible with solar and deep insulation stuff. The other thing is, every day of the year, we are open to our neighbors. We invite our neighbors in to come join our programs, our lectures. We, as Cindy mentioned, the permeable walls, we're a real believer in bringing everyone in and having everyone welcome and feel really good about what we do. And finally, on Station Street, I mean, I could say a whole lot more, but I think I won't. On Station Street, one of the challenges, if you know that area of town, which is where I live, it's a wonderful area of town, it's two different levels, and it's really hard for people, unless they're extremely mobile, to get from one to the other. So we're going to have an ADA pathway that will actually allow people to go from the T in Station Street right up to Kent Street in the heart of Brookline Village. That's just one of the public services that we think. So I'm just going to wrap it up now and answer questions by just saying I just hit my 10th anniversary of being at Two Life Community as a CEO. I'm really proud of that. When I came, one of my first goals was I got to get into Brookline because I've lived in Brookline since 1985 and I don't want to live anywhere else. And I do want to age in community and we didn't have anything. And so we're in Brown House, we're going to be on Station Street and we'll be looking for other opportunities. And I ask you to invite us to other places because I think what we do is really powerful, really unique and really supportive of the larger community. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. So we're going to have a discussion. We're running over without any doubt, but I think it's worth it. So we're going to have about a 10-minute discussion. I'm going to open it up somewhat. I have questions of my own, but I think I'd like Jennifer to, if you have, I'm sorry, Jennifer, Dr. Malinsky. I'm kidding. Jennifer, if you have anything to start it off, I'd love to hear it.
Just to say that it's such an incredible diversity of things that are happening in Brookline, and I was saying before this webinar, before I was asked to do this, I was already touting the wonderful things happening in Brookline. So it's really impressive to see and exciting to see the range. And I think that the other panelists talked about a lot of the filling that need for the accessibility, addressing loneliness, talking about affordability, and then all the wraparound things that we need, like parks and accessible walking places. So I would just say that this is all very exciting.
So I want to just get a little bit. You answered half my questions. These were, I thought this would take, but this is good. Technology, which is an area I like and I'm interested in. And we just had a show on our age-friendly city show actually last night that was on the technology for older adults. How do you, each of you, support technology in your environments? Or what do you see as technology's issue?
Well, I'll jump in. Okay. First of all, our buildings are all Wi-Fi enabled, so people can use their iPads and cell phones everywhere. We do use technology thoughtfully, hopefully thoughtfully, with daily activity calendars that are updated regularly, that we also have monitoring systems that our healthcare staff can monitor residents if they are going to the bathroom more often than normal or up and about. We're able to, in a thoughtful, non-invasive way, know that so we can begin to observe whether there are other health issues.
Great. Anybody else like to chime in?
Yes, similarly, we use technology to in the effort to keep people well and healthy and safe. And one of the things we offer is a wellness check-in every morning, hearing the voice of our director of social services, checking in and making sure that the resident is okay with their request to be included in that. And then if they don't respond, then someone from our team goes to check. We also do a lot of virtual programming like this, especially in this time of COVID, to keep people engaged and not as lonely as they would otherwise be, and really involved. Some of the groups that met before in person, knitting and short stories, and many of those groups still meet now virtually. And then keeping up with programs with some technology as well. We will be looking into in-home technology, expanding on that in the new building. That's came out as a very high level request from the residents of Brookline who responded to our Brookline resident survey.
COVID had nothing to do with it, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Everybody's aware now. And I assume the same thing in Kent Street? You're going to have
Yeah, we will. I have to say, technology for us is an evolving situation. When you have a median annual household income of just under $10,000 a year, you're paying attention to a lot of other things, as well as whether everything's Wi-Fi enabled. But at the beginning of COVID, of course, we pivoted, and within the first week of the the shutdown, whatever you want to call it, we had our fitness classes on video. And we now have our own TV station where we're doing a lot of our own programming. We found that a lot of our residents, particularly those in their 90s and 100s, found it difficult to use. Even when we did give out Chromebooks, it wasn't exactly comfortable, but the television station is a much more familiar thing to that. So it's evolving. We're going to move in and change with times. And as we build new buildings, the next generation of older adults will be more tech savvy. So we will be doing, every one of our buildings always has a computer center with computer instructors who help people both one-on-one and with classes. And it's part of our social engagement as well as the technological.
Anybody else want to comment on that, or I can move on to a question that's very important to me. Brookline. So we've got a lot of new people in Brookline and a lot of new areas. And how in the world can you encourage, and I've been through experiences trying to get various people from various existing housing areas, and they've gotten involved, they want to, but it goes for a little while, but there's transportation questions. They want to get to the library. They want to get to the senior center. They want to get together, right? When things are reasonable that you can get together with other people from other areas. How do you handle getting people to be available to use our facilities, our libraries, our Coolidge Corner Theater, the senior center, all the various areas? Anybody want to comment?
I'll take that one, Matt, if you don't mind. So we have found that with a lot of instruction, our residents are very eager to take advantage of the different transportation that's available in the community. And we now have a zip car that is going to be parked in the parking lot at Brown, so that it's a rideshare service that everyone can take advantage of. We also give specific classes on how to use and access the transportation that's available in our community. So we have a van that we use, but we also, you know, we'll take advantage of the wonderful services offered through the Brookline Senior Center. And then of course, we're right on the bus line. So with enough education, I'm very sure that our residents will be able to take advantage of all the different transportation options.
Now I'm getting nervous. The senior center's getting married.
Similarly, yeah, right around the corner, similarly, we have a van, and in normal times we have transportation specialists, and we go on lots of trips to exciting destinations locally, and being located in Coolidge Corner with the public transportation is a huge plus.
Right. And we did hear Michael before. I'm very impressed with that transportation. Your comments on transportation. And you can't possibly know at this moment, Mike Jacobs.
Well, obviously, almost all of our developments are senior developments, with one 24-unit development south of Route 9 are located right within Coolidge Corner. So in terms of accessibility, they're all there. So we obviously don't have bus services, but they're very accessible to public transportation.
Great. I'd like to bring it to a close, but if anybody has a question or something they want to bring up with someone else, we have a couple of them. We can go for a minute or so. But if not, yes, Amy.
Can I just make one comment? I just want to, I used to, in the DeVal Patrick administration, I was the head of public housing for the state. I just want people to appreciate the Brookline Housing Authority, how different it is, how advanced, how clever and progressive. What they're doing is just something we hoped we could encourage others to do, but they're setting the model for the whole state. And I just want to acknowledge it and thank the Housing Authority.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close it. The forum provided a lot of things. Right. And but I think that future forums will also exist. We're going to examine various results, how the developments that existed that are being developed, what happens to them, how they became a fabric, part of the fabric of the community. And I'm looking forward to our founder and Frank Caro, who pushed all of this and is still pushing it, and looking forward to the future forums that he develops and thinks of. So thank you all for attending, and thank you all panelists for contributing.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.